Thank you. And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Dan from San Diego.
I'm Dan, I'm an alcoholic.
Dan.
Thanks, Mark, for asking me. It's a privilege to be here. It's a privilege to be able to participate in my own sobriety, and it's great to be in a place where there's a lot of AA, and it's pretty easy to participate. And welcome to the new people, and welcome to our friend from Oklahoma City, and congratulations to Marlon and the young lady that took 90 days. Congratulations. So if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not like an expert at AA or a doctor or some type of authority. What I am is a drunk that got sober through Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have any like special knowledge of AA. And you know, alcohol. This is my opinion that alcoholism is a condition and it's a disorder that encompasses a whole lot of stuff. And there's a whole lot of things that are wrong with me that kind of get a free ride in through my participation in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I always talk about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'll do that. And I'll do that for 45 minutes.
45 minutes.
45 minutes. And so what it was like, I was born July 25th of 1958, and I had a brother who was 2 years older than me, and my mother was a school teacher, and my dad was a sales guy, my dad sold stuff in different businesses, and I lived on a street. I had cousins, so my dad's brother lived seven doors down, and there were three boys at 2 years increments above my brother. So I had family all around me, and we've counted in them on that street that I lived on that was probably a quarter mile long. There was 28 kids, all within 5 years of me. And I grew up in a beaver cleaver kind of environment. There was kids all over, and we would go out in the we'd go out in the morning and we'd play with all these other kids, and we would go to whatever kid was around's house, and the parents, the mom or whoever would feed us, and it was just all kind of one big happy family, and everybody got along with each other. And I grew up in a pretty ideal situation. My father was a hard-working, really good guy. He's the best man I ever met. And my mother was a wonderful woman and still is with us today. And I grew up in a really nice environment, and you know, hard-working people with good values. And as a young kid, I was kind of like hyperactive and stuff, and I still am to this day, pretty kind of charged up. And As a youngster, like, I was pretty peaceful. I remember, I tell this story all the time, but I can remember, and this is just an example of one of many experiences, but remember those little, like, those Cox gas airplanes that you used to wind up, and they had a little motor on them, they flew really fast, and you had two strings to it, and it would go about halfway across this room, and you'd fly them around. I don't know if you guys remember those, but I can remember flying one of those. I got one for Christmas, and I was completely thrilled and psyched about it. And they're hard to fly and when you're brand new at it. And so I started it up, and I kept crashing it. And it was a beautiful day. It had just rained, and everything was green. It was probably right this time of year. And I'm in a field. I'm in this play field, this little league field, and I'm all alone, and it's late in the afternoon, and the grass is damp, and I'm flying this thing, and finally I get the hang of it, and I'm flying this thing around, and I'm in sync with my musculature, and my brain and everything is synced up with this plane, and it's all instinct, and I'm flying this thing around and around, and I'm not thinking about anything, and I'm not thinking about anything, and I'm just there in the moment. And I'm completely at peace, and everything is right with the world. And I can remember feeling that looking back, I remember feeling that at that time. And that wasn't unusual for me when I was like a young guy. I mean, I was pretty peaceful and calm. And I was raised in an environment where kind of that was the case. And so I was, I lived in a... I was like, I grew up in the 60s, and like when I was 6 and 7 years old, I was walking a mile to school and walking a mile back alone every day. I mean, I just had a lot of freedom, and that was kind of the condition that the society was in that day. And so I'm this kind of calm kid, and I have a lot of friends, and I have a lot, I'm just not thinking about myself all the time back then. And I don't know what happened, and I remember I walked home, and like I had drank, like my dad would drink these things. He would drink these Olympia beers in a can, and I don't know if these things were 6 ounces or what, but they were tiny. Like as a little kid, I could wrap my hand all around it, and he's like, yeah, I mowed the lawn, and I'd like to have a beer, so I'm going to relax and have a beer, and he'd have like a tiny little beer, and I was like, And I remember taking drinks out of his beer and thinking, this is just nasty. Like, how could these grown-ups drink this stuff? And so I'm in eighth grade, and I came home from school one day. And my brother, who's 2 years older than me, who's in 10th grade, when you're that age, that's a lot older. And he was hanging out, and he was a surfer. And, like, I kind of, like, wanted to impress. These were the cool kids that he was hanging out with. And my parents drank. I mean, they would have parties and they would drink, and like my dad would kind of get mildly drunk, and I mean, I could tell the alcohol affected you. And came home from eighth grade one day, and it was no different than anything else. And I went up there, and there's this, like, you know, there's iced tea and clear and all this other looking stuff. And I drank some iced tea looking stuff, and it tasted nasty. It tasted like gasoline, and it just like burned my stomach. And I thought, oh, God, how could anybody drink that stuff? Like, this stuff is awful. And I waited not long, and I thought, well, you know what? Maybe the clear stuff's better. And I remember the second bottle I got was gin, and I thought, oh, my God, this is even worse than the gasoline tasting stuff. This is, like, really bad. I waited, like, a few minutes, just like we do. And I thought, well, maybe that other iced tea stuff looking, that brown stuff, maybe that's, and so I just sampled the whole thing, man, the cream de menthe and all the, like, the, just all of it. And I remember walking out, and I walked out to where my brother and his friends were, and I was talking to them, and it was different. Like, I could, something was really different about all this. And this guy, I don't know what happened to this guy, and I don't know why I remember him, but his name was Mike, his last name started with an L, said, Dan's drunk. And I thought, yeah, you know what? Dan is drunk. And I liked being drunk. I really liked being drunk. And I thought, this is great. And there is a kid that lived two doors down, that was a sweetest little, like a gentle kind of frail kid. And I'd played with him since I was like 4 years old. And I just went out and for no reason beat him up. And I think I feel about it. And then I threw up, and I don't remember what happened, but I remember like I found something. Without knowing the words, it's like there was something that was different. And what I didn't know was there was a switch that got lit in me at that time. And that switch was never to be unlit. And I liked drinking. I knew it. And there's this other stuff involved. I grew up kind of by the beach. I grew up close to the water. And there's other things involved in that get a free ride with my participation in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got very involved in all that, like as a really young guy, and with the drinking, I got in trouble. And by the time I was in 10th grade, I'd been arrested twice, and I had to go. The guy would send me these passes at school to go see him. It was the drug counselor, and it was a different color. Like the regular pass, like it would be green, and like this guy had a red one or something. So somebody would come in and hand a teacher a red pass, and the teacher would say, Dan, here. And I'd be like, all the kids would be snickering and saying, yeah, Dan got one of those passes to the drug guy. And I just was starved for attention at that point. And I thought, yeah, like if that's the way, and I didn't know any of this until like now, I'm looking back. But I was starved for attention, and I liked the attention. And good, bad, whatever, as long as like all eyes were on me, I was fine. And this guy, my dad played high school football, and this guy was on my dad's team, and they knew each other, and like there was no like escaping any of this stuff. And I was a train wreck at home. I mean, I was causing a lot of problems in it, like what otherwise was a very peaceful house. And except my brother was doing all this stuff, but too. We were doing it together, and so it wasn't a peaceful house. It used to be a peaceful house. I lost my train of thought here. Oh, and so this guy, so like my dad and this guy would talk, and there was no escaping. That like everybody knew what I was doing, and I'm still a young guy. Like I'm what 10? I'm 15 years old, and they said the guy called me and he goes, "I got a deal for you. If you could drink on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, you can drink all you want. You can, you know, just don't get in trouble. Don't get arrested again. But drink Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and don't drink the rest of the days. Can you do that deal?" And I said, "Oh, of course I can. I promise I will adhere to these conditions." And for a 15-year-old punk kid, that's a pretty good deal. And I had no intention. I've always done the, yeah, sure, that's, of course I will. But I had no intention of doing that. And I couldn't. I didn't last, like, as a new drinker, like a newcomer to drinking, I didn't last, like, a couple of weeks in that program. And I had a bad problem, and I was the only one that didn't know it. And my mother had told me, all the men in my mom's family, my mom had suffered some tragedies as a little girl and moved out from Texas. She grew up on a small ranch in Texas and moved here with her mother after her brother was accidentally killed and the father left. And all the men on that side of the family are just bad alcoholics and go to jail. And they're like otherwise good people, but they wind up beating somebody with a shovel or something. And it's just tragic. Like I've heard, like I've gone back there and heard about it, and it's tragic. And the thing is, it's not unusual. That's what we do. And I'll never forget, she told me, she said, like, "I know you do this other stuff, but beware of alcohol." And I had, you can't tell me anything, particularly as it pertains to my alcoholism. And problem with alcoholism is once you find out you have it, it's way too late to do anything about it. And that's kind of like a problem. And I had it at a young age. And how am I doing time-wise?
Yeah,
I'm good. Am I good? Okay. Am I halfway done?
No.
No? Okay. Okay, you guys are going to hear the whole thing tonight. I like to talk about like what when I got sober. I'll get sober in a minute. I'll tell you the whole thing. But there was a guy that I got sober one time for 4 days before I got sober. And I'm taking a little step aside here to interject in this thing. And I got sober and I went to a meeting a lot like this. And there was a guy there that spoke named Tom P. And he's also known as Frogman Tom. And some of you guys might remember Tom. And he passed away. And I don't know what it was, but like I heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't even know it. And this guy talked, and I'll never forget this guy was talking about. But like there was something where I left that meeting, and I had like, that would have been 2 days sober. And like I was different than when I got there. There was something like completely different. And this guy carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he talked a lot about like what he was like when he was drinking, and then what he did to get sober in AA, and a little bit about what it's like now. And that's, I've always tried to, I never forget, like, what that impact that had, because I drank after that. And I'll just tell this. And so that's kind of why I do what I do. Not that you really needed to know that, but okay. So where was I? So I'm a punk kid, and I'm getting in all kinds of trouble. And what happened was I just kept going along that track, and lower companions, lower and lower people that were doing, you know, like I started out just drinking, and then like there was these criminal acts, like these just like low level pain in the ass kid stuff, and then like I was hanging around with these people that were doing some stuff that was pretty bad. And one of them got murdered, and it opened my eyes to like really where I was heading, and it shocked me. And coincidentally, with that, just one of these strange coincidences in my life, I talked to this kid, and this kid was really involved in martial arts. He said where he did it, and like there was some thing that went off in my switch that went off in my head, and like I had to do it, and I drove out there, and like I got very, very seriously involved in this. It's very similar to Taekwondo, and this was like in the late 70s and stuff when that was all was kind of very popular. And so like I got very involved and very focused on that, and there was like when you did that there's writing on the wall too. It's like it was really, and I just got very involved in that, and I graduated. Like I barely made it out of high school, but I did. Like I graduated from high school. I didn't know what to do, and I had a couple of jobs. Like I work, you know. Like my problem has never been failure of effort on my part. Like, and I was working, and I was like training really hard, and I was going to junior college. I was trying to like see what that was like, and what happened was that I started, my drinking was continuing, but the pattern was different. And the pattern for me was drinking was all about punishment and reward. Reward and punishment. And like, there's a lot of liquor available in my house. And because like I got in so much trouble, my folks told me, they said, listen, you can have a daily allotment of booze. And if you know, just try to limit yourself to this amount, whatever amount, it doesn't matter. But, I was, it was like two beers a day. And if you think I'm going to drink two beers a day, you don't know me. But there was a ton of other liquor around there. They used to buy it in bulk. And, like, I drank pretty much as I wanted when I was, like, 17 years old. And so my drinking became all about punishment and reward. And I wouldn't drink during the day, but at night, every night, I drank like a lot. And then I would come to in the morning, and like it might not have been like I went out on some wild blackout, but like I couldn't have told you what I was doing exactly when I went to bed. And I started blacking out every night. And it doesn't have to be a big dramatic thing; it can just be lack of memory of what I was doing. And I have an incredible, you know, I'm particularly good at drinking. Like, I'm pretty good at drinking. I had a flight. I have a 20-year-old daughter that was in Rome, and I recently visited her, and I flew back. And it's a 12-hour flight. It's a long flight. And I was sitting next to this lady that was drinking, and a nice lady, and she'd have a glass of wine, and I'd say, can I get a water? Can I get a Diet Coke? And I had like four or five Diet Cokes by the time that she finished the wine. Finally, I'm like, God, aren't you going to drink that thing, lady? It's been sitting here for like 2 hours. And I mean, and that's what normal people do. Normal people will drink half. I mean, as strange as it seems, a normal person will drink a half a glass of wine and won't want anymore. And go figure. And so you get the pattern. I drink all the time. And what happened to me was, like, I was fairly successful at the stuff that I wanted to be successful at. And I went from a two-year school to I found something I wanted to study and wanted to do for a living, something I liked that I thought would be a good thing to do. And I went to this four-year school, and I studied it. And kind of the death knell for me was when I turned 21. You know, it took me, like, I was doing okay at school, but it took me like 6.5 years to do 4 years of college. And so halfway through this thing, you know, I turned 21, and that was kind of it for me. Like, when I, because I always had money because I always worked, and when I could have booze whenever I wanted, as much as I wanted, it was kind of game over. And I started failing out of school and doing really poorly and go to academic probation and taking income, you know, just the stuff that happens. And I was drinking more and more frequently, and so I got really kind of heavy, and so I quit doing any kind of physical training, and that was like the beginning of the end. And from time to time, I would drink in the morning, or, you know, at least you could have a few beers with the guys for lunch. And, you know, like, the afternoon drink became the morning drink. And once I started drinking in the morning, it was game over for me. And time was elapsing, and I barely made it out of college. I got out of college. I had a 1.875 GPA. I saw the transcript the other day. And I was on the odd even plan. Spring was like good, and fall was probation, and spring was good. But the deal is, you can't have any two consecutive semesters in academic probation, and I did, but it was I graduated that second one, and I got out, and it became time for me to become self-supporting through my own contributions. I was living with my folks. And there was just no way that I could even get this thing off the ground. And so what I did was I would wake, my folks were hardworking people, and they would go to work, and I would wake up, and I knew that I was smarter than the rest of everybody, and that, you know, a successful high-flying guy like me just needed to get a plan going. And what I needed to do was just get a plan and, like, implement my plan so I could rise above everybody in some fashion. And you know, like, my nerves were pretty jittery, and really, to get the plan going, what you really need is just, you need a half pint of pop-off, like, no more than that, just a half pint to get the morning started and get you rolling. And so I'd go down and I'd get a half pint of pop-off vodka for like $1.57 or something, and I'd put it in my left sock, and I'd walk out of the liquor store, and I'd drink it, and I'd go home to get my plan going. You know, I'd get out a piece of paper, and I thought, you know what, maybe I could just watch, like, Leave It to Beaver before I get the plan going. And, the Beverly Hillbillies is going to be on pretty soon. And, you know, at the end of the day, the Rockford File. I can remember the whole thing, the whole day. And I never got a plan going. I never did anything. But, like, after a couple of shows, the half pint of pop-off was empty, and I probably had a beer or two, and, you know, another half pint. I kind of screwed the pooch on the plan thing, so, you know, why not get another half pint and watch? And I just sat in a house and drank cheap vodka and drank beer, and dinner would come around, and I couldn't eat because, like, I was just anxiety-ridden, and holding down food was a problem, and I'd get a couple of tall cans of Schlitz malt liquor with the bull. Don't let the smooth taste fool you. You got anybody remember the Schlitz malt liquor bull? Yeah, there you go. Yeah, and while that was going on, like, I had had traumatic and tragic things happen in my life, and none of that really mattered. I mean, what really mattered was the feeling that I had inside of myself about me. And about, like, how I was just wasting my life, and how I was a young guy that was just completely afraid to do anything. And so the only thing I could do, instead of facing up to the very fact that I was afraid, I just sat and drank. And I just thought I was a piece of garbage. And I couldn't think about anything other than me and all my friends, and anything decent in my life had left, and I just was mooching off my family that deserved better. And and I knew that deep down, way down deep in every cell of my body, I knew that. And late at night, because, you know, like, I'd stay up late because my neurology was completely mangled. And they used to have advertisements late night on TV for a place. Raleigh Hills was like, I guess it was a treatment center. And they used to say, you know, you got a drinking problem? Call Raleigh Hills. And so one night I called Raleigh Hills, and I'm serious. And they go, hello, Raleigh Hills. And I said, yeah, I got it. Like, I'm a bad drinker. I think I'm a bad alcoholic, and I need to quit. And they said, well, what's your name? I said, my name's Dan. And they said, well, Dan, do you have any insurance? And I said, no. And they said, Dan, do you have any money? And I said, no. And they said, Dan, you need to go to AA. And so I went down to Central Office. And Central Office, when it was on 4th Avenue, and I'm just smelling a vodka, and there's the pamphlets were on a magazine, one of those circular magazine wire racks. All the pamphlets were in there. And so I walk in Central Office, and I start looking at all the pamphlets, and a guy came up to me and says, hey, anything I can help you with? And I'm like, no, I'm just grabbing some pamphlets, you know, like pamphlets. I saw there was a book, so I bought some pamphlets, and you know, the thing that impressed the heck out of me was I read some of these pamphlets, and they didn't, Alcoholics Anonymous didn't want anything from me. It didn't cost me anything. It seemed to be, they didn't want me to join a church. They didn't want me to do anything. What they wanted was to help me. And just in reading a few pamphlets, it's like, these guys got no axe to grind. They don't want anything. Maybe I ought to try one of these meetings. And I went to and you know what? If you're new and you have come here, it takes an incredible amount of courage to walk into Alcoholics Anonymous. And congratulations, if you're new and you came here alone. And, you know, we all come here alone and afraid, and we think, well, everybody else knows everybody. And, we have this erroneous idea about life. And I went to this group, and it was on the it was in one of the back rooms behind the Lafayette Hotel on El Cajon Boulevard. It's called the Brave Wind Group, and why I remember all this stuff, I don't know. And there was, you know how you hear, you'll hear people complain and say, I don't want to go to AA meeting where there's a light bulb hanging from the ceiling and a bunch of old men in trench coats. And this was a light bulb hanging from the ceiling and old men in trench coats. And they were winos, and they're like, yeah, I used to drink Sneaky Pete in the, they would go to the, these guys went to the all-night theaters. And they would say, yeah, we'd roll the wine bottles down the theater. There used to be all-night theaters downtown San Diego, 24 hours a day. And I loved it. I felt right at home. And they told me, they said, you know, I didn't know you're supposed to say, hi, I'm new, and I'm Dan, I'm alcoholic. How would you know that, right? And they said, yeah, kid, you didn't say it, but you're an alcoholic, and, you know, you're one of us. And they just told drunkologs, I went to another meeting, and then I went to the meeting I talked about where Frogman Tom talked on Saturday, and I stayed sober a Sunday. So that's four. That's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And Monday I went out. I probably looked a lot like I do now. I went out, and I looked for a job, and I was about 55th in university, and my car turned into a 7-Eleven, and I walked into the 7-Eleven, and way down on the bottom of the cooler was a bottle of 7-Eleven wine. You're talking about Gallo, right? It was probably that kind of product. And I bought it, and I went out to the car, and all of a sudden I was looking at the roof liner, and there was a bottle of 7-Eleven wine in my mouth. And I was never a 7-Eleven wine drinking guy. And it was like getting in a car wreck. I just kind of watched it happen. I had no ability to stop it. It just happened to me. And I drank that, and I started drinking again, and I couldn't stop. And I had heard enough in AA and read enough pamphlets to know that, I was powerless over alcohol, and my life was unmanageable, and that I was screwed. And I was once a young man that had incredible willpower that could do a lot of things that people told me I couldn't do. And applying that willpower to not drinking does me absolutely no good. As a matter of fact, the harder I try to not drink, the quicker I get drunk. And that's not a theory to me. I live that. I couldn't get out of that. And I stayed in that condition for every day for at least a few months. And So I'm in that condition. I'm trying to not drink, and I'm drinking, and I'm trying to stop, and I'm looking at the clocks, and I'm not going to drink today, and my nerves are coming undone, and I'm getting violently ill when I don't have alcohol. And the second thing, big problem with alcohol is, besides the first, is like that I mentioned, like once you find out you have it, it's way too late to do anything. The problem number two is alcoholism is what happens to me when I'm not drinking. Not drinking is my problem. Actually, drinking's a pretty good way to solve all these problems. Not drinking's like my issue. And I can't not drink. And I found out why when I got here, read the doctor's opinion. And so I'm living in this condition, and it's a hot night, and it's late September, and I have a half pint of pawpaw vodka right here in my left sock, and I drank it, and I finished it, and I threw it in this ivy, and I knew that I was a piece of garbage, and that there was no way for me to ever get sober, that this the craving and the obsession that I had in my mind about alcohol would never, ever, that it was just too much for me, but I was going to go to AA, and I was going to try as hard as I could. And it was all these events looking back. And I was living, mooching off my parents, living in their life. And I went in and told them, I go, look, you know, I'm a bad alcoholic and I got to do something about it. And they're like, yeah, we know. And I'm going to go to AA tomorrow. And they're like, yeah, tomorrow. And my dad and mom were hardworking people, and they had this trip planned for like 5 weeks. They're going to New England and Montreal. They're taking a big trip of their life, and they go, well, we're going on our trip, and good luck to you. And I went to AA, and I think I went to a meeting during the day, but it was a Friday, and I went to Pacific Beach Young People's, and I was young. I was 24 years old, and I went to Pacific Beach Young People's, and I go, because I had a schedule, and I go, this seems like it'll be, you know, there's young people there, and there was all old guys, all guys my age, and I don't know what they said, but I'm just coming out of my skin, like I just can't eat, and I had a coffee can, a Folgers coffee can, that I would dry heave up into, and like I'm dry, I was just violently ill, and these guys are talking about it. Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a language. And, like, if you're new and you don't understand the language, don't worry about it. You don't need to understand this stuff. Like, you understand it later. And the main thing is to have your head hit the pillow tonight sober at midnight. And, like, you've done your job. And it's not even your job. It's God's job. And you're doing the busy work, and God does the heavy lifting. Just trust me on that. And so it's the end of this meeting. Everybody stands up, and I stand up, and two grown men grab my hands and, like, hold hands. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is like a – I'm not a grown man, whole hand-holding guy. And they said the Lord's Prayer. They said the Lord's Prayer. And I'm like, oh, no, not this. And, like, I don't know what the problem would be. Like, I needed help. And so we went to – I was going to drink, and I didn't know, like, well, this is AA, I don't know what, and so I told these guys, I go, you know, it's time for me to drink, and I'm going to go drink, I just can't take it, like, I'm coming unglued, and I don't know what's going to happen, I don't know how bad this is going to get, and then, well, you know what I mean, I go into the AA panic kind of thing, and not the AA, but like the alcohol panic, and the guy says, well, do you want to not drink, and I go, yeah, that's why I'm here, I want to not drink, but I can't do it, and the guy says, well, we think we can help. And I said, really? He goes, yeah, because we go to coffee after the meeting. And I thought, every fiber in my being demands that I drink alcohol. Like, there is no way for me to not drink. And coffee? How is that going to? And I thought, okay, I'll do it. And I went to this coffee shop with these guys, and I was brand new, and I didn't know. And I got in the middle. They go on in, and I got in the middle of the booth, and they're all smoking, and it seems like they're screaming. Like, they're talking to each other, like, right close by, but they're screaming and laughing about all this stuff that wasn't funny. And I asked them, I said, can I get out? I got to go to the bathroom. And they said, no. And they wouldn't let me out. And I said, come on, I really need it. And they're like, we know, we know. And They like have coffee and calm down, and like I wasn't, there's no way anything staying in my stomach. And the reason I'm telling this is that so we get out, we're done, and we're outside, and we're in this gravel parking lot, and it's late, it's like 11 or something, and I said, well, what do we do now? And they looked at me, and a guy says, well, we go home. And I go, I said, what do I do? And a guy says, for you, you better pray your ass off. And they all got in their cars and they drove, and I'm just standing in a parking lot, and I'm like, this is it? Like, now all that's left for me to do is pray my ass off. And I put my hands in my pocket, and I was out, and I walked up and down the boardwalk from the jetty to Crystal Pier and back pretty much all night long, and I prayed my ass off. I set my jaw, and I go, God, please, God, don't let me drink. 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 Up and all night long, and something happened that today just impresses the crap out of me. And when the sun came up the next morning, I didn't drink. And like I had one day sober. And I had no way, there was no way in the world me having one day sober was ever going to happen. And I had tried, believe me, I had tried and exerted all my effort to stay in sober for one day and couldn't do it. And I went to this AA place and I sat down with these guys and I prayed my ass off and somehow I stayed sober. And it wasn't about me not drinking, it was about me doing this other stuff. And I was convinced of two things. One is there's something to this AA thing. There's something to it. And number two, there's something to this praying thing. And I didn't know about, you know, I just thought there was something to praying and saying, God help me. And that's all I knew about it. And so perfect. Got to wrap it up. So I was sober and I was going to meetings for a couple of weeks. And I found something out that this problem was far worse than I had ever thought. And I was alone with a mind. When I wasn't thinking about drinking, and I was thinking about not drinking. And both drinking and not drinking seemed like good and bad ideas all at the same time. And that's confusing. I mean, that's really hard. And that stuff was going on in my mind all day, every day. And I'd heard like the inventory and stuff, like I'd been in enough meetings of getting myself in trouble, and excuse me. So I wrote this stuff down, and I asked this guy for help, and I said, you know, I got these problems, and they're complicated, and the guy said, listen, hold the train, man. Your problem is really simple. What you got is untreated alcoholism. And the way that we treat alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the main things is we take the steps. And the way that you could start the steps is by reading the doctor's opinion. So I want, read the doctor's opinion and call me if you want to. But like if you don't read it, don't call me. Because we really don't have much to talk about if you don't read a doctor's opinion. And for some reason, I wasn't offended. Like for some reason, like I was just, I took that objectively. Because the guy was a good AA guy. He didn't like lace it with a bunch of sarcasm or anything. He just said, this is what you should probably do. Call me, don't call me. He was going to have a good life one way or the other. And I went home and I read the doctor's opinion. And for some reason, it made sense to me. And I didn't know at the time, but I was never going to be the same again. Because I had like the facts of my condition, and I was willing to accept the facts of my condition. And real soon thereafter, I asked another guy to be my sponsor, which was like, I have a friend that says, when you're new, asking a man to be your sponsor is like asking a man to be your Valentine. And it is not easy. And I asked this guy to be my sponsor, and he said, are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol? And I said, yes, I am. And he goes, well, we'll see. And which is really kind of the appropriate response, because, this guy was a worse alcoholic than me, and he said, listen, we don't diagnose alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is something we don't do, but like in your case, I'm making an exception. You're a bad alcoholic. You're going to drink again probably really soon. You're doomed to drink again, and our book promises that unless you take the steps and do what, and I believed him. And I would like to tell you that I just did it happily. I just waited until actually till I got in pain and I started doing them. And he told me to write some stuff about step one and two, and I didn't do it. And I went over to his house, and he said, and I, you know, he knew that I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable, and I was willing, I believed that there was a power greater in myself that would restore me to sanity, and that power is Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was, and I was, he asked me, are you willing to be willing that there's a God that will solve your problem? And I said, yeah. And he said, okay, thank you. Take my hand and we're going to say a prayer. I'm like, you mean right here in front of this window? And he said, he looked at me like, you can take it or you cannot take it. I'm going to have a good, and I didn't know it at the time, but I said a simple prayer with this good man. And when I stood up, I was different. I was never going to be the same again. And, you know, he laid into me, launched into the thing. You know, this could have, although it was a vital step, could have a little permanent effect unless immediately followed. And so I immediately got into taking about 6 months to 9 months to write an inventory that really took about 4 hours. And that's how long they take. And this guy was never, ever at home. He had one of the, you know, back then he had answering. This was in 1982. And he had an answering machine. And he never was at home. And I wrote this inventory. And I'm rushing through this because I'm running out of time. I wrote this inventory, and I was never going to read it. And I was struck with a realization after this inventory was finished, and I was sitting on it. It was like carrying around like a cinder block chained to your foot. And I was living my life with a cinder block chained to my foot. And it finally occurred to me that I was going to do this Alcoholics Anonymous's way, or I was going to drink, and there was no third option. And I made this decision. I went to a phone booth, and I called this guy who was never home, and he picked up the phone on the first ring. Hello. Come on over. And I read what I had on that page to him. And I didn't know it at the time, but I was never going to be the same again. And I was different than I was even when I stood up after that prayer. And we said a couple of more prayers because, like, I was willing. Like, I was willing to have the things that stood in the way of me and my Creator removed at that time. And we did some stuff, and by then I was well on my way. And you know, it became really apparent to me without him telling me, without him really saying anything about it. It became apparent to me that, like, I screwed a lot of people over, and there was really going to be no recovery for me. And that if I wanted to quit drinking for real, that I needed to face up to those people, and I did. And I didn't tell him what I wanted to tell him. What I told him was what he told me to tell him. And we had talked about this, and we had read through the book. And it, I asked people the courtesy of a meeting, and I got in front of them. And I told them that, you know, I had harmed them, and that I had already apologized many, many times for that. And that apologies didn't mean much, but what I was there to talk about that day was I wanted to hear what they could tell me about how I could make it better for them in the long term. And that making these amends was about restoring these relationships to their original condition. And I didn't know it, but particularly that one, I was never going to be the same again. And I can remember walking. I remember talking to my sponsor. I said, what about, like, when I stole a bottle of tequila? Do I got to pay that back? And he's like, of course you got to pay that back. And I remember, you know, particularly with my, and I got a couple minutes left, so I'll leave it with this. I remember walking. I always had, like, a bad back. My back was, I was full of tension and fear and everything in my back and my neck, and I had all these headaches. And I remember going to a liquor store and kind of just looking at my feet and telling a guy, you know what, like, a long time ago I would regularly steal tequila from here, and they were like $5 bottles, and you know, I think $30 would probably do it. And I left the stuff on the counter, and, like, I just kind of left. I did the best I could. And I remember walking a few blocks away, and I had this strange coincidence where all of a sudden I noticed, like, that my neck wasn't bound up, and, like, I was free from all this pain. This mysterious pain that had plagued me was all of a sudden gone. And it took a long time for me to equate that with, like, making amends. And I got 1 minute left, and what it's like today was I did the stuff that, like, I've talked about, and I've continued to do it for a long period of time. and that I didn't do it through grace. I did it because I was supported by good people and people who gave me the AA kind of love, which sometimes like is a nice ear and sometimes I kick in the ass. I'm sorry, I kick in the rear. And what I got today is peace. I have, I got peace on the inside. And like any measure, if you knew like on my outside, if you knew like the who I lived with and the way that I lived and the gifts that God had given me, it's astonishing that the life that you guys have given me. And I've been very generous with your time, and thank you for letting me speak tonight.